The term sick building syndrome has gained currency in recent years. Even the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has had its problems with it. And while many people still say hypochondria is at work, many other people with severe allergies or asthma report that the places they live and work affect their condition in clear and direct ways. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk with a building inspector who specializes in conducting indoor environmental surveys of homes, schools, and offices. Jeffrey May is president of J. May Home Inspections in the Boston area, and he frequently writes and lectures on the subjects of air quality and home buying. He is also author of the book, My House is Killing Me, The Home Guide for Families with Allergies and Asthma, recently published in both hardcover and paperback by the Johns Hopkins University Press. In the book, Jeffrey May describes in microscopic detail the allergy-causing denizens in your living room carpet and many other things you probably don't want to know about, but should anyway. Besides, our guest also offers remedies to deal with the problems he describes, which is the point of our conversation during this hour. As we talk with Jeffrey May, your questions are welcome. All you need to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states our signal reaches, and via the internet anywhere you are listening in the U.S., 800-222-9455. Around Champaign-Urbana, that's 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Jeffrey May joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Jack. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for being with us. I want to maybe start by asking you to describe the scope of the problem we're talking about. You write, "We inhale fragments of the outside world with every breath. What is in the air we breathe?" In some ways, we probably don't want to know too much, but we probably should.
Yeah, I think a lot of people probably focus more than they should on the outdoor air.
Mm-hmm.
Really, most people spend the better part of their lives, over 90% of the time, indoors. And so largely what they're breathing is generated from their environment within. And the things, the problems, I've investigated over 600 buildings now where people have actually been sick because of what they were breathing in their homes or in their schools or places of work. And the biggest problems are dust mites, cockroaches, and mold. And then the sources, the biggest sources, seem to be the things where we spend a lot of time. It's very, very ironic that that we're indoors and our favorite places are often the areas that are making us sick. So typically you'll find, let's say, carpets that are contaminated or beds or couches or heating or cooling systems. Those seem to be the biggest offenders.
Mm-hmm. Now, not everyone is affected equally by this. In fact, some people probably aren't affected much, if any, while others are affected quite drastically.
Yes, actually, a lot of my clients, and I have been told to see a psychiatrist because they've seen so many doctors and their symptoms are different from time to time. Nobody can quite sort of figure out really what's wrong. And so, you know, people think that they're crazy. Husbands and wives have fights. I mean, I've actually had situations where people were divorced shortly after, you know, my investigation because there were so many emotional issues entailed with the one person being ill and other people not being ill at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think also maybe on a personal level that reflects that in many ways our society is denying that these problems exist, whether it be, you know, an office building where, you know, remedying the problem would cost a lot of money. So, you know, it's viewed with skepticism, to say the least, to on a personal level where, you know, we may actually be getting ill, but we don't want to consider the idea that it may be, you know, dust mites in our mattresses or whatever.
Yeah, oh, I think so. I think there's you're right. I mean, there's denial on every level, Jack. I mean, there's the government. I mean, you had that situation with in Cleveland, actually, with a Dr. Door. I think Dearborn Door, and those babies that were exposed to Stachybotrys, and I think the government had put up a lot of money for some research initially, and then pretty much withdrawn all of their support because they felt that there wasn't adequate scientific evidence that they'd been made ill. And yet there are many, many indoor air quality researchers, people who are involved in this area, that, who themselves have actually investigated homes and then become quite ill just after spending a short period of time in the environment.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the reactions that we're talking about have to do with allergic reactions. Isn't that correct?
I think so, but a really good example would be to just take a mold spore. I mean, most of the mildews growing in the house or in indoor environments. They'll be Penicillium or Aspergillus, and anyway, some of them are actually pathogens. But typically, people will have some sort of allergic reaction. They may be coughing. They may have asthma as a result of that. But there are also more sort of basic immune responses, and I think, at least in my experience, a lot of people who were exposed, at least chronically, to mold, they develop immune-type problems, fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. So, there may be allergy problems, but I think there are a lot of other types of reactions that people have depending on their individual immune system and bodies, the way they react. And then there's one sort of overriding issue, and that's the issue of the mycotoxins. And I think that was one of the big problems with the Stachybotrys in Cleveland, that there are actually chemicals that are in the mold spores that are really very, very poisonous. If anybody is exposed to a mycotoxin, they can potentially become ill from that. It has nothing to do with being allergic or not. It's just simply a poison. There's a particular type of Aspergillus, Aspergillus flavus, that produces aflatoxin, and that's one of the most carcinogenic compounds known. So there are actually components in many molds that can cause cancer.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about where these things come from, and maybe a way of doing this would be to ask you to talk about, when you do a home inspection, how do you go about it? What are you looking for?
Well, the biggest problem would be sources of moisture, because anytime all of these organisms that can cause allergy and asthma problems, they depend upon moisture. So the first thing what I'll do in an investigation is to start at the outside of the building and be sure that there are no sources of exterior moisture. And it's important, something that homeowners never do, and it's so simple, is just on a really heavy, on a day when there's a very, very heavy rain, is to just go outside your house and take a look at the house and see where the water is going. Sometimes people think their gutters are working and the water is overflowing and it's ending up in a basement window well and it's going into the basement. And a lot of folks don't even realize it's that simple, that just having too much water around the outside of the house can cause basement water problems. So when you have excess moisture on the outside of the house, you end up with, you can have foundation leaks or water on the floor and then mold growing downstairs, and that leads to mite infestations. Another really, really significant source of moisture is just the air itself. And I used to teach chemistry, so I try in the book actually to explain a lot of these different principles, because the idea I have is that if people really understand the problems and how they arise, that they're equipped to deal with them. They can sort of take charge of these things. So relative humidity is another big source of moisture. People don't realize that when the air is damp above, let's say, 60-70%, that mold can just start to grow. Mildew can grow on surfaces. So you'll find it in, let's say, in bathrooms where there's high moisture on the ceilings and walls. You'll find it in basements on the walls and growing in carpets and in furniture.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see. You have a bunch of images in the book, mold growing on carpet fibers, that even carpet that is designed to be resistant to microbial activity.
Yeah, I think it's a very important point that a lot of people miss, who buy all of these things which they are, supposedly allergy-proof, carpets and pillows. Most of the growth and the problems that you see, it's in the dust, and that's sort of, the book. This is a book about dust and what happens in dust. I look at dust under a microscope, and then I can see what's happening. I find hairs in people's beds that have been chewed by organisms. I find pollen particles that have been chewed up. And really, you shouldn't be seeing these things. And so it's the dust that really serves as the nutrients for the mold, for the bacteria, for the yeast, and for all the little things that crawl. And moisture is key for the life of all of these organisms.
I certainly want to pursue and ask you a few questions about dust. Sounds like a typical public radio conversation. But we have a listener waiting, and let's include them in our conversation.
Sure.
This is someone on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
I actually am not asking about allergies, but I just heard you mention aflatoxin. And years ago, I used to work in a health food store, and I remember at that time there were some people that were quite concerned about aflatoxins in peanuts, and I've wondered about them in peanut butter, and then I think I heard somewhere that, oh, well, they're not in peanut butter. So do you know anything about the presence of aflatoxins in our food supply?
Well, I believe that there are regulations for foods to actually be tested for mycotoxins. I'm not certain of that, but my understanding is that there are actually some regulations for aflatoxin in milk, specifically because it can get in from the grains and also in peanuts. But just sort of anecdotally, I can tell you that just recently I was eating a handful of peanuts, a very popular, you know, brand of peanuts, and one of them had this very off taste to it, and I noticed another peanut that had a little black sort of cap on it, and I looked under the microscope at the, you know, I took a sample, and it looked to me as though it were an aspergillus growing on there. So, you know, I think mold growth is relatively common in foods in general, and I believe in particular for aflatoxin that there are some actual regulations. I know that there's another mycotoxin from another aspergillus. It's called ochratoxin, and there actually are some limits for that. And grains are tested for these things pretty regularly. There are companies out, you know, in the Midwest, your way there, where they actually take big bags of grains and test them.
Do you think that if you buy things in bulk, they would be more likely to contain such kinds of toxins?
I think it's possible. It's not very expensive to have some of these things tested. So if you're associated with, you know, let's say a food co-op or something like that where they're getting a lot of these, it would certainly be worthwhile because I personally, having seen the extent of the sort of mold contamination in buildings, I believe that some of the cancer that's out there may in fact be due to people's exposure to mold. In fact, I wrote a paper about a home on Cape Cod where there was Aspergillus ochraeus growing in the heating system. We took the sample of the duct dust, and the level of this ochratoxin, the mycotoxin, was the highest level of ochratoxin that had ever been observed in any sample, and it was actually confirmed by government scientists. It was over 1,500 parts per billion, and I think the limit in foods is about 2 parts per billion.
But kind of packaged food like jarred peanut butter probably wouldn't be a problem.
Well, probably not, but, you know, that the larger company would have to be monitoring things, you know, a little more closely. But I think any time you buy anything bulk, you know, a lot of people don't realize this, and I've done this. I've looked at, let's say you have some sort of leaf product that's a dried leaf. If you look at that under a microscope, you'll often find that a significant portion of that is mold, because the leaf, you know, we all know what happens to leaves in the environment if things aren't dried quickly enough. So you can imagine that in a, you know, grain storage, if the relative humidity is too high, you can very, very rapidly, within a matter of days, probably have mold growing. And they actually will allow, it's sort of interesting that if they detect the level, let's say, of 2 parts per billion of ochratoxin in a grain, let's say in corn, they will allow the grain operator to dilute, to cut it with corn that has a, you know, much lower value, so they can, if they do it a 50-50, they could cut it in half, and then it'll pass. So there actually, there's tolerable levels of these things generally out there anyway.
Right. When you say, are you saying micro or mycotoxin?
Myco, M-Y-C-O is the prefix for meaning mold. So it's myco, M-Y-C-O-T-O-X-I-N, mycotoxin.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yep.
Thanks very much for the call. Other callers are welcome. We're talking this morning during this hour, Focus 580, with Jeffrey May. He is the president of J. May Home Inspections, and he specializes in indoor environmental surveys of homes, schools, and other buildings. And we're talking about much that is in his new book, My House is Killing Me, The Home Guide for Families with Allergies and Asthma. If you'd like to join our conversation, your questions are welcome. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Returning to dust, I want to ask you to talk a little bit more about what is in this dust and how you go about analyzing the content.
Well, I have I basically have a couple of different kinds of sampling equipment or strategies. One is really to just sample the air, and I just have a small machine that sort of draws air in through a small slit, and there's a glass slide inserted in the machine, and the particles that are in the air land on the glass slide in a little bit of a film of grease. Then I stain that and look at it under a microscope. Alternatively, I may just take a sample of dust from a vacuum cleaner or from a wall, and or use a piece of scotch tape. It's a very common method that indoor air quality people use. You just put a piece of scotch tape on the surface, draw it off, and in every case I stain it and then look at it under a microscope and try and see what's there. And you know, it's a battleground, really. It's wonderful. It's fascinating. You take a piece of little quarter inch piece of scotch tape and look at it under the microscope, and you can see a sort of a history of what's happened in places. Which the insects that have been there, the battles that have gone on. You know, sometimes you'll find insect fecal pellets with mold spores that have actually started to grow, that some organism ate some mold and left this little fecal pellet, and then there was such high humidity in the environment that the spore survived a little trip through the digestive tract, and it's now growing.
So some dust is a kind of a world unto itself.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, I can sometimes spend an hour on a little spot of dust that you wouldn't even see. And the thing, what's so remarkable about all this, I mean, some people think I'm a little bit crazy to do this, but the bottom line is that that's what makes people sick, because when you walk around, when you bang on things, when you disturb these dusts, you breathe it in, you know, and people don't associate illness with air, because unlike dirty water, which you can't really see through, you know, if somebody gives you a glass of green water, you're not going to drink it, you know, but if you're in a very, very contaminated environment, you may not see anything or smell anything, and the air doesn't look any different than the air would if it were on top of a mountain. So these are very, very significant issues.
Can you talk about some of the ways in which we can sort of address dust issues? I mean, carpets are pretty renowned for being a place where a lot of things can grow and dust can collect there, and when you walk on it, it kicks it up. Mattresses and pillows, even.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, the key always, though, is that, you know, we can't keep dust out of our lives, because we actually generate a lot of the dust that's in the house. We lose about 30 grams of skin scales of skin every month. So most people who complain about dust in their homes, they're really only complaining about their own skin scales. If you have dogs and cats, you'll find a high percentage of the dust will be dander. So sometimes the dust is a problem, sometimes it's allergen if you're allergic to a dog or a cat, but I mean, in general, the dust is benign. It's only when there's a location where you've got excess moisture, where now you can get microorganisms and then other insects that feed on the microorganisms, that you really can have problems. And the big issue for, let's say, for people who don't own their own homes, or people that are, you know, renting and they have furniture that's been there from other people, you don't know the history of the furniture. So it's possible that, you know, even though you maintain your apartment or your home very well, that somebody before you perhaps didn't, and some item became contaminated, and now you will be exposed to that forever.
Could you talk about dust mites as a common cause of symptoms?
Well, yeah, dust mites are very, very, very common organisms, and but a lot of people try to dismiss them because they say, oh, they're everywhere. Well, in fact, they're not necessarily everywhere, and it's the numbers that really count. I mean, you may have one or two dust mites growing in the dust somewhere, but if you create moist conditions, then you can have larger numbers because they depend sort of critically on the relative humidity. And so when the relative humidity is above 70%, you can have a lot of dust mites. And that causes asthma. There's no question about it that in my mind, that people who have beds or carpets or couches with high levels of dust mites, that does contribute very strongly to the asthma symptoms.
What do they live on? What is their own sort of life cycle, and how do they affect our human health?
Well, they basically forage on the skin scales, and they eat, they defecate, and they reproduce. And it's the fecal pellets that are actually contain most of the allergen. They're pretty small, and they become airborne. So I find some pretty crazy things, you know, like, let's say, you have, as the population ages, more and more people are retiring, spending time at home. So a lot of folks, they'll be sitting in front of the TV or computers all day, or they'll be reading in their favorite chair. And we give this so many skin scales in the dust. There's plenty of food out there, so it's the relative humidity that's sort of really crucial. And that moisture comes from our bodies. And when I tested the relative humidity in my bed, while I was in bed. And although it's not that high around in the air, where your body is actually physically lying on the mattress, the relative humidity is about 80%. So the dust mites only need 70% relative humidity, and so that's really basically how they're surviving. They imbibe the moisture from the air, and we provide it for them.
Well, I don't want to give anybody nightmares, but mattresses, apparently are particularly prone to populations of dust mites.
No, absolutely. I don't mind giving people nightmares at all, because then they can go and buy the book and then figure out how to solve the problem. So let's give them the nightmares.
Okay. Well, aside from buying the book, how can they begin to address then, you know, if they are concerned about dust mites in their pillows and mattresses? And
yeah. Well, the most important thing to do is to put the covers on the pillows and on the mattresses. There are these the allergen control covers, dust mite covers. Basically, they are plastic. Some of them will have a sort of little fleecy surface on them, but people don't quite understand how these things work, and so it's very important that they do understand that, because you can make a mistake. When you put a dust mite cover on a mattress or on a pillow, that really does solve the problem completely, and it does it for two reasons. One is because it's solid and it's plastic. It prevents the allergen from escaping, so when you get onto the bed, the allergen can't escape from this plastic bag. But the other thing that it does is it prevents the moisture, which is really the key to the growth of these things, to prevents moisture from getting in. So any mites that are present will simply die. And I know there are people out there companies that are selling the so-called breathable covers for mattresses and pillows, and I'm a little bit concerned about those, because if they're breathable, that means that moisture can still get in, and therefore the mite populations can, you know, potentially maintain themselves. And there's sort of somewhat of a misconception about allergens and dust mites. I mean, everybody says, well, the allergens are on these big particles and they can't get out. Well, not all of the allergen is on big particles, and some can get out. And so I think if you have a porous cover, that you have the possibility of still having a dust mite problem and an exposure problem.
We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. We're about in our midpoint. We're talking with Jeffrey May. He's the president of J. May Home Inspections. We're talking about indoor air quality and what you can do to guard against allergens in your house and office and other indoor environments. Questions are welcome. We have two people waiting and lines open for others. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, I'm going to have to hang up after I ask the question.
Sure.
But I heard that there's a fellow called Prospero, University of Miami. He considers himself an expert on dust. And I know he said that up to one half of the breathable particles in the air over Miami are made up of African dust. And so I was just wondering if you could talk a little, if you know anything or could talk a little bit about it.
What kind of dust? I'm sorry?
African.
Oh, African. Okay.
Yeah, and I was just wondering if is that a, I mean, is, are there other international dumps of dust from one country to another, and does that constitute any kind of health problem? And I'll have to hang up and listen. Thank
Thanks for the question.
Yeah, I guess there, you know, there are sort of clouds of dust that go into the atmosphere from all kinds of activities. Some of them are natural, and some of them are man-made activities. So there, I read that too. That from they had desert storms and particles get into the air of dust. And there's a mold from Cuba that I think it's called blue mold that affects tobacco plants in the Carolinas, and they can actually detect those in the upper atmosphere. And there have been cases, I guess, I think it was in Barcelona where they found that. That the asthma emissions would increase when they offloaded the soybeans in the harbor, which would be, you know, a quarter of a mile or half a mile away. So I think there are local disturbances, there are long-range things that can send various particles go over great distance, even living little insects. But I guess I have to go back again to the, you know, what our exposures are for every, you know, for every one outdoor particle that's relevant in an air sample inside a building, there'll probably be 99 of them that are generated within the building itself and the heating and the cooling system, or, you know, from coworkers or furniture or carpets or whatever. So most of the exposures, I think, that cause problems indoors are generated indoors. I guess there are, you know, there's people who have pollen allergies and mold allergies to the exterior air, and certainly those things are relevant. But I think the most relevant exposures indoors are those that are generated by the indoor sources.
Yeah, well, plus there's something you can do about those indoor sources.
Absolutely.
You can't really block, you know, the dust blowing across the Atlantic Ocean, although certainly it's something to be aware of. Well, we have several other callers waiting. Let's go next to a listener on line number four. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. Thank you for this program on clean air. I wanted to know, when you wash the sheets and pillowcases, what besides the hot water, what else could I put in the water to make sure the dust mites get killed?
You know, you really don't have to do much of anything for the sheets, because dust mites can only really survive in a very, very sort of cloistered environment. So they only really, they live inside pillows, they live inside cushions, they live inside mattresses. They are very, very fragile. You know, people worry about their curtains and things like that. They'll be in quilts as well, because it's a thick cushion material. But dust mites don't really live in sheets. They may get into the sheet because they come out of the mattress when you're in bed, and they'll get into the sheet. But the most important control for mites is to have a cover on the mattress, have a cover on the pillow, and not to use down pillows or down quilts. I think, you know, people really use overkill. If you eliminate the dust mites that are in your mattress cover the pillow, that's usually the biggest source, unless you have, for some reason, a contaminated carpet. And now you can have curtains, you can have anything you want in the room, because you've eliminated the source. The reason dust makes people, let's say, sick or have allergy problems is because it has allergens in it that come from somewhere. If you eliminate the source, then you eliminate the problem.
Well, we have done that. We've put those covers on.
Have you done it on every bed?
The one we could and that was necessary, we did.
Okay, but see, that's the big mistake that people make. They often, you know, they'll have, let's say they'll have three kids, they'll have one child with asthma,
well,
they'll put the covers on that child's bed and pillow.
We don't have a problem like that. The thing I wanted to find out was, how can you, is there any way now that you can see where they are?
You can't see the dust mites because they're too small, but it's very easy.
Yeah, I know that.
Yeah, it's very easy to sample. You can just simply, there are companies that sell little kits. It's just a little vacuum kit. It's a sort of a filter bag. You put it at the nozzle of the vacuum cleaner, and you just vacuum for a few minutes, and then you send it off. It costs about $50, I think, and then they'll just send you back a result, and then you're not fighting phantoms.
Uh-huh. And does the electrostatic room cleaner really kill them?
No. There's the only, as I said, you know, the only thing that really solves the mite problem is the elimination of the source. I mean, if you have, let's say, you could have 50 electrostatic cleaners and electronic cleaners and ozone generators and everything on the earth in your room. If you have a dust mite infestation in your pillow and you don't have a cover on your pillow, you're going to breathe the allergen and get sick from it regardless of the equipment that's running. So source removal is always the key.
Well, I've done that. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. We have a couple of the callers. We'll take next line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
You talked about the moisture being a problem, and I wondered, I have a number of allergies, and normally in the winter I have breathing problems, but last year it was a much colder winter, and we had snow on the ground, and I felt the best I have for a lot of winters. So I wondered, my atmosphere is pretty dry in the winter. And most people are concerned about dry air. If you have a dry enough environment, would this sort of eliminate some of the dust mite problem?
Well, somewhat, but not necessarily, because again, see, I've seen this, you could be in the middle of the desert, and if you sit in a chair, you know, and watch TV for 5 hours every day, the relative humidity in the chair is going to be 80% where your body is. And so you can have a very big mite infestation. You can even be growing mold. I mean, literally, we're incubating things like hens when we sit in one place like that. And if it happens that there is a colony there, you're going to supply it with moisture. When you get up, what they do is they crawl back down into the cushion and hide. They actually, I've had mite colonies, and you watch them. They're extraordinary. They form a big bundle the way bees do to stay warm in the winter, and they prevent themselves from drying out, and they just sit there completely motionless. They look like opossums, dead. And then as soon as you get into the chair, your body moisture raises the relative humidity, and they're up again. So I don't think that, you know, being in a dry environment is necessarily the cure. What I recommend for people with asthma and allergy problems is that they either have leather or vinyl furniture, or that they have, they use a lot of futons in their living rooms, and then cover the mattress as soon as you buy it with a dust mite cover, and that prevents having a big thick cushion available for mites. They can't survive in the colorful, you know, cover lining the material on top of the couch. It's too thin for them. They would dry out.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. We'll go on and talk with some more listeners. Next up, someone on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. You answered part of the questions on the electrostatic air cleaner. There's another thing called an ion generator. Is that worth anything?
Well, I think a lot of these, you know, again, there are all kinds of sort of machines out there to, you know, to solve air quality problems, and you know, to some extent, they may, you know, remove some of the particles. Like, creating charges causes particles to stick and, you know, together and stick to surfaces. But, you must always remember that if you've got a contaminated rug or a contaminated carpet or a piece of furniture in a room that is generating these allergens, that it doesn't matter how many machines you have or how many filters, that nothing is going to be entirely effective, and that you always have to, you know, take care of that, the source. And then you may, you know, improve the air quality somewhat by, you know, using another machine, but that should never be the first thing that people spend money on. A HEPA vacuum, for example, is probably it's probably one of the most important things for people with allergy problems. I've sampled the exhausts from vacuum cleaners and found, you know, really high levels of mold and mite allergens. In fact, in the book, I talk about a family where they moved into a new house and they all became sick. They had allergy problems, and they were all very allergic to cats. And I took air samples, and cat dander is very, very characteristic. You can see it in a microscope, and there was a lot of cat dander. And these people were horrified. They couldn't understand, why do we have cat dander in this new house? We put all new carpets. Well, they had hired some cleaning company, and the cleaning company used these cheap, leaky vacuum cleaners at the neighbor's house where they had cats, and then came into their house and used the same vacuum cleaner. So if you're going to spend money on something, you want to first get the mattress, you know, get the mattress and pillow covers, and then buy a HEPA vacuum cleaner so that you don't resuspend all the allergens.
The old vacuum cleaners where the air used to pass through the cloth bag, that wasn't too efficient, was it?
I'm sorry, the old vacuum cleaners, I didn't hear the whole question.
Well, they originally, they had a cloth bag without a paper bag inside.
Right.
Oh, I see.
And that looked to me like that only caught half of that, the heavy stuff.
Yeah, I think, you know, you really, those uprights, some of them are really, really dirty. In fact, some of them you can see where the, you know, with the zipper, where there's a layer of dust, and
right.
That creates an enormous problem. So, you know, it's you really want to buy a HEPA vacuum cleaner that's made, not an optional thing. You know, there are some companies that are now selling these little add-on filters, and you can be wasting a lot of money. I actually looked at one where the clips that held it on had big holes, and so when the vacuum cleaner was operating, most of the air just bypassed the HEPA filter and came out the little holes.
I see. The pilot lights on a gas stove. I had three pilot lights going here. Does that put out any pollution?
Well, it can't, actually, that's an interesting question because I have a couple of cases in the book about that where people have gotten quite sick. What pilot lights? I talk about this. They thermally decompose any kind of pollution that's in the air. So maybe you've noticed this if you ever paint anything in your apartment. You get this horrible pungent burning smell afterwards. And what I tested on my own stove. I tested for carbon monoxide in the flame, and there was no carbon monoxide at all. I turned the gas on for a second, and then turned it off on another burner so that there was some gas in the air, and immediately the carbon monoxide went up to about 20 or 30 parts per million because of the incomplete combustion. And I've seen this in many homes, older homes, where they've got pilot lights and there's a small gas leak. There are levels of carbon monoxide. They're not very high. They're only maybe 5, you know, 6, 7, 8 parts per million, but the only reason they're there is because of the pilot light, either from the combustion, the flame itself, or from the combination of the gas leak and the flame.
Is it a blue flame or a yellow flame? Which is more efficient on a gas range?
Well, all of the pilots have yellow flames, and that's why they produce carbon monoxide. Whenever you have a yellow flame, that means you have incandescent carbon particles, and that's what gives it that yellow light. So when you're on normal circumstances, you should never have yellow flame. It means that the burner has to be adjusted. Whenever you've got a yellow flame, that means that there's not complete combustion, that there's some carbon monoxide being produced. And that's partially why some of the pilots will produce a small amount of CO. It's not a high level, but there are people that are sensitive enough to combustion products where it's a problem.
If you took the air in an apartment and passed it through an activated charcoal filter, would that clear up some of those?
Well, it might, but those activated charcoal filters don't really last a very long time. They sort of, you know, it has a limited capacity. So once again, it always goes down to the same thing. Eliminate the source if you possibly can. You can turn the pilots off if it's a problem, or just, you know, get a spark ignition stove.
Oh, that's another thought. Well, that meets another gas range then. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have just about 8 or 9 minutes left with our guest, Jeffrey May, author of the book, My House is Killing Me, The Home Guide for Families with Allergies and Asthma. It contains a lot of advice about how to deal with a variety of indoor air quality issues, dust being one. There are certainly others. And we have one caller waiting and probably time for others if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone on our line number 4 next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen, and Happy New Year, and what a great conversation you got going here.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
I maybe missed a few minutes, and I know you lightly touched on this, but what, in a best-case situation, in other words, you think you're doing all the right things, what percentage more allergy-type situations might you be producing if you have pets in the house?
Good question.
Well, there's pets, you know, can obviously be a problem for people, and often families are in denial. I mean, I had one situation where this family had some ferrets with a very sick child with allergy problems, and they tried everything for this kid. And at one point, I wanted to get a couple of photographs of the ferrets, and I had the mother hold the two ferrets on her arm. And I to take just for a picture. And when she took the ferrets off, she had welts on both arms. And I mean, he was somebody who was worried about her child and was herself sensitized. So a lot of times people are in denial about their pets. And if you really love your pet, I mean, there are a lot of things you can do to minimize the dust. But when you're talking about kids with asthma, I think then you sort of pass over the line where you really have to think about, you know, finding an alternative home. But the dogs and cats obviously are allergens. Another thing people don't realize, birds produce an enormous amount of allergen. I've had several clients now with hypersensitivity pneumonitis, which is a very serious lung disease because of the exposure to the birds. And, you know, they got better within a matter of months after getting rid of the birds. So they can be a problem. Some of the ways that pets are actually can be a problem that people don't realize. The animals, I had one actually family where the kid had all these rashes in bed. A child slept with a cat, and the cat spent all day in the fiberglass insulation in the ceiling of the basement. So the cat was covered with fiberglass particles. I'll take an air sample from, I'll pet an animal and then take the air sample of the dust coming off. And a lot of times there'll be mold spores in there, there'll be pollen particles, there'll be dust mite droppings or other insect allergens. A lot of the animals are like a little dust mop. So they'll go around, they collect a lot of things. So an animal actually can be a source of exposure of a lot more than just the allergen itself. Some people buy these big down beds for their pets, and, you know, they wash their own sheets every week and wash the covers and the mite covers. But these pet, you know, the very expensive pet beds, they're about 3 inches thick, and a lot of them are down, and they can get completely infested with dust mites and carpet beetles. And so they're it isn't just mites. I mean, we're worrying about all kinds of insects. I have on my website, myhouseiskillingme.com, I have a long sort of photo essay of a wool moth problem. I mean, if you have got a lot of wool moths in a carpet, for example, you can have a problem. If you've got a pet on the pet picks up the allergen. So it's complicated.
Yeah, it sounds like it's very, very complicated. So no matter the best case scenario, pets are going to be problematic, but like you say, we love them, and I guess if we're surviving, I guess you just have to put up with it or get your book and do a little research, and maybe you can at least limit
the problem. Right. You limit you do your best to limit it, the dust, and, you know, restrict the pet, and if it continues to be a problem, then you have to, you know, make some hard decisions. And if you, you know, the thing, a lot of people don't realize this, that, you know, a lot of these allergens last forever. So, you know, you can move in. I get calls all the time from people. They've just moved into an apartment, and they're so sick, and they've cleaned everything. I will sometimes find, you know, tablespoons of dust in a radiator or in a baseboard convector. And just that dust can make somebody sick for a long time.
Well, what an interesting program, and thank you very much.
Okay,
thanks for the call.
Again.
All right. We have a couple calls waiting. We'll try to squeeze one or both in the time remaining. We'll go next to line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, good morning. I wanted to ask a question. You often read about advertisements suggesting that you have your home heating and air conditioning ducts cleaned and sanitized. And another question would be how much efficiency is in these filters that you often see advertised for your furnaces.
Okay, that duct cleaning can make a very, very big difference, but it's not so much duct cleaning. What you have to be very careful of is if you hire a duct company, you've got to be absolutely certain that they use only HEPA vacuum cleaners. It is not adequate to have simply a truck-mounted vacuum and what they call an air whip. They'll put something through the ductwork and bang things around, and they have a little vacuum, you know, truck-mounted thing. It's not adequate. They can actually disturb the dust. So part of duct cleaning, obviously, is cleaning the ducts, but then, and sometimes even more important, is that the blower motor itself has to be cleaned. The air conditioning and the cabinet, the furnace, blower cabinet, all has to be cleaned. Like, I've seen many homes where they paid people to have the ducts cleaned, and I'll go in and I look inside the blower cabinet or some other part of the heating system and find that it's still filthy. So if you get your system cleaned, then you must have the entire system cleaned, including the air conditioning coil, which we haven't really talked about at all, but air conditioning coils get completely covered with mold. I mean, who hasn't turned their air conditioning on and noticed the funny little rotten smell, you know, that sweat sock odor? So that's indicative of a problem. And the way you avoid all of these problems once the system has been cleaned is with proper filtration. And I don't like those washable filters. You can spend a lot of money. Nobody ever washes them enough. You know, filters soak up dirt. You want to have one that you can throw away. You want something that's as efficient as you can get. And the best type is what's called a media filter, M-E-D-I-A. It looks like a sort of accordion pleated, folded piece of cardboard. And those things have the proper efficiency to keep the system clean. But the key to having a healthy heating and cooling system is having it clean to begin with. And then, secondly, the best possible filtration that you can put on there.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're running out of time here, and there's a lot more we could talk about. We certainly wanted to talk about heating and cooling and air handling equipment, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And I'm sorry there's a caller that we won't be able to include in the conversation. I will suggest for folks that if you'd like to learn more on the subject, look for the book we've been discussing, My House is Killing Me, The Home Guide for Families with Allergies and Asthma. It is recently published by Johns Hopkins University Press, and the author has been our guest, Jeffrey May. M-A-Y is his last name. And do you want to mention your website once again?
Yeah, it's very easy. It's myhouseiskillingme.com. I also have a lot of case studies on www.jmhi.com.
Okay, so there's some good resources. And to you, Jeffrey May, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jack.
All right, take care.
Have a good new year.
Thanks, you too.